Thank you very much. It indeed is a pleasure to be here, and particularly to honor Professor Corson. We not only share the same university, we have many of the same interests, but I especially want to commend him for the excellent textbook he wrote. As an undergraduate, I struggled with electricity and magnetism, suffering from both a poor textbook and a poor professor. I managed to get an A in spite of that, but I felt I never really learned it. Then I took a graduate course and had the same experience. And then finally I had to teach, and at that time the textbook came out, and for the first time I really understood electricity and magnetism. And I have to thank Professor Corson for that. I think the best thing I can say about a book, it's the first time I've experienced a case where a book became, in my mind, became the classic the first year it was used. And it has for a long time since then served as a classic. I'm also pleased to honored to share the podium with Congressman Brademas. I've heard so much about him. Our paths haven't crossed before and I haven't met him. But certainly an honor to be here. I mentioned to him, this is the first time in my experience that I've been part of two members of Congress serving occupying the same platform at the same symposium when it was not devoted to political discussion. So maybe the organizers of this are trying to send you a subtle political message. I noticed they carefully selected a Democrat and a Republican. I also serve on it's now the Education and Workforce Committee rather than Education and Labor Committee. Having said those introductory comments, and also I want to thank you for inviting me to be here. This is only my second time at Cornell. As was described to me yesterday, you are proud to be centrally isolated. And in a sense, that's appropriate. But when I received my PhD, after 4 years of an intense work with no breaks, my wife and I decided to travel by car to Quebec, where I was giving a paper on the results of my work. And one of our stops was here, and we explored the canyons or gorges. It's a beautiful location, or as my daughter reminded me yesterday, I was supposed to tell you this is a gorgeous location. She's an academic and apparently heard that from a Cornell graduate. Having said that, let me return to my preferred role as a professor and jump down from the stage. Use transparencies and so forth, and pretend that I'm still in the classroom. I was asked to talk about science, policy, and politics, and I before I get into that, I want to just discuss briefly one of the reasons I've tackled this vigorously. First of all, one of the reasons I've got into politics from an academic career. It's an unlikely profession for a physicist. I did not realize it until after I was elected, but I'm the first research physicist ever elected to the Congress of the United States. The only thing remarkable about that is that it's a real indictment of the physics community that none of us have ever been elected before. But this shows the reason that I became involved and felt we had to redo the nation's science policy. If you look at what has happened to the federal budget, and I've just split it into three large areas, the entitlements, that includes Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, welfare, student loan programs, was only roughly a quarter of the budget in 1962, interest on the debt approximately 10%. All the rest was discretionary and defense. Discretionary and defense, that is the money that the Congress can allocate. The rest is automatic once Congress has passed a bill, established a program, all those who qualify will receive that particular stipend. 1980, notice how the entitlements have grown as well as the interest on the national debt. 1998, entitlements now 53% of the total budget. Interest on the debt, 17%. That totals 70%. That leaves only 30% for discretionary and defense, of which defense is one half. And I certainly agree with Congressman Brademas's comments about the need to define what our defense posture should be. We're currently spending approximately $1,000 per capita in this country for defense, and we have not clearly defined our purpose, our agenda, the need for defense since the end of the Cold War. Now, that relates to my discussion about why I got involved in science policy, and I'm also going to apply this to two areas of interest that I was asked to address and which are of particular interest to me. One is math science education, the K-12 regime, and secondly, how this relates to the future of the research university. So let's talk for a few moments about the report which I prepared toward a new national science policy. Now, this particular report was, it took a considerable amount of work, but if you were familiar with the Congress, as Congressman Brademas is, you would recognize that we do not give ourselves any more resources than we give anyone else, in fact, frequently less. If I had arranged for a National Academy study on this, it would have cost considerably more. I did this study with two science fellows who were provided through the AAAS fellowship program and working part-time in addition to my congressional duties, which today consume roughly 80 hours a week. And so I didn't have too much time to spare on this. So we did the best job we could in that amount of. I had 12 months to do it, working part-time with the two staff members. But above all, you have to recognize this was written for the Congress. There's been a little criticism of it, as I expected, that it was nothing new, it was shallow, and so forth. I don't think that's quite true, but even aside from that, I had to educate the Congress about where we are and where we should go, and that meant writing a primer, in a sense. Now, the reason for this is that the U.S. has been particularly poor on establishing a science policy. In fact, for most of the early history of this country, it didn't have a specific science policy other than to establish things that were needed for defense, such as the Naval Research Observatory and things of that sort. But there is one major area in which the national government invested money in research, and the Yusuf University is an example of that, and that is through the land grant system. Our country invested in research in agriculture much more so than anything else during the first 150 years of its existence. And I might say with considerable success. And I've always been envious as a scientist viewing the incredible research program that's been developed in the agricultural sciences and the means to get it to the people through the cooperative extension program. In my state, when Michigan State University discovers something in the laboratory one year, the farmers are using it in the field the next year. Most everything done in scientific research has a lag time of anywhere from 10 to 20 years before it really reaches the public use. And so I think we have to model after the cooperative extension program. Well, after that 150-year period, we had the World War II, in which science and its relationship with the federal government changed dramatically. It's amazing to the scientists of today that there is so little contact between the federal government and the scientific community that in order to make the federal government aware of the possibility of nuclear fission and nuclear weapons, we had to get the famous scientist already referred to, Albert Einstein, to write a personal letter to Franklin Roosevelt telling him about this possibility. That led to endless cooperation, including radar, on which President Corson spent some time working during the war, as well as on the Manhattan Project. At the end of World War II, the President Roosevelt asked Vannevar Bush, who was his point man in science during the war, what we should do next, and he developed what became the nation's science policy through his book, The Endless Frontier. Excellent piece of work, but nothing has been done since then, and what has changed is the end of the post-war. We have reached now what George Brown, former chairman of the Science Committee, used to say, a period in which we do not have a science policy, we have a budget policy for science. And that's what I've tried to change, saying we have a major change taking place here, and we simply have to begin thinking seriously about what we should be doing and how we should do it. The vision statement I prepared is simple, straightforward, although I must say I was surprised that it survived a study of the committee and so forth. But I simply said the United States must maintain and improve its preeminent position in science and technology. in order to advance human understanding of the universe and all it contains. That's always been the objective of scientific research. And furthermore, to improve the lives, health, and freedoms of all peoples. And that sounds rather idealistic, and in fact it is, but I'm convinced that is a possibility. I'm not one of those, incidentally, who believes science can solve all problems, particularly social problems. But I think science and technology and engineering have the ability to improve the standard of life of developing nations, to introduce political stability, and from that you end up with improved lives, health, freedoms of all peoples. In the course of this, or early on in this, I developed four theses, which I would like to just outline very briefly to you. First of all, that our science policy is outdated. I think I've already shown that. Secondly, that the American public does not understand science or its practice. I and any of the scientists or engineers here could give you multiple examples of that. One of my favorites is, and I'll use examples from my field of the physical sciences, one of my favorites is that if you ask the American public today, how long does it take the Earth to orbit the Sun? Only 50% of them are able to tell you that it's 1 year. Now, that is the basic definition of a year. It's a bit of knowledge that has been known through various cosmological models for several thousand years, but only half of the American public can tell you that. Let's take a look at something a little more esoteric, and I want to show you a brief video interviewing Harvard graduates on the day of their graduation. Some of you may have seen this already. I'll only show you 2 minutes of it. If we can have the video, please. And the question is, what causes the seasons?
Consider, for example, that the causes of the seasons is a topic taught in every standard curriculum.
Okay, I think the seasons happens because as the Earth travels around the Sun, it gets nearer to the Sun, which produces warmer weather, and gets farther away, which produces colder weather, and hence the seasons.
How hot it is or how cold it is at any given time of the year has to do with the closeness of the Earth to the Sun during the seasonal periods.
The Earth goes around the Sun, and it gets hotter when we get closer to the Sun, and it gets colder when we get farther away from the Sun.
These graduates, like many of us, think of the Earth's orbit as a highly exaggerated ellipse. Even though the Earth's orbit is very nearly circular, with distance producing virtually no effect on the seasons, we carry with us the strong, incorrect belief that changing distance is responsible for the seasons.
I took physics, planetary motion, and relativity, and electromagnetism, and waves.
I've never really had a scientific background whatsoever, and I got through school without having it. I've gotten very far without having it.
I had quite a bit of science in high school, yeah, through physics, one first year, and 2 years of chemistry.
Regardless of their science education, 21 of the 23 randomly selected students, faculty, and alumni of Harvard University revealed misconceptions when asked to explain either the seasons or the phases of the moon.
When it's further away from the sun, then it gets colder.
The Earth's position interferes with the reflection of the sun against the moon.
That's 1924. Okay, that's it. I like the faculty member's explanation the best. It results from reflection from the moon. At any rate, for those of you who may not know, the distance from the sun has very, very little, if any, to do. In fact, in the northern hemisphere, we are closer to the sun during the winter and farther away during the summer. Well, something that everyone presumably has been taught in high school, and certainly at a college-level course. 90% of these students had it wrong. Furthermore, the test has been repeated at other campuses with identical results. 90% say it has to do with the distance. One test, one survey, had the interesting follow-up question after they gave that answer, and that was to say, well, what about Australia? And then they were totally stumped because all of them knew that when we have our winter, Australia has our summer, and therefore their answer is wrong. Well, the point of this is simply to say that the American public does not understand science or its practice. And I've just given you aspects of knowledge of science. What's even more important is their lack of understanding of the practice of science, and that's something we really have to change. And since I have a large number of members of the humanities here, let me add something additional. President Rawlings gave a superb speech about the importance of the humanities, and I've always supported knowledge of the humanities. That's partly why I went to teach at a liberal arts college. I believe it's extremely important. But I also regard the sciences as part of a liberal education. And it always amused me that it seemed to be one-sided. A good example of that is sitting over coffee one day where an English professor was expounding at great length about the inferiority of the writing of the student papers he was seeing, and that particularly the lack of precision of language and words and so forth. And a bit later he commented that his wife was not well that day. He thought she had a temperature. In which case I observed him that perhaps in the interest of precision of language, he might have said that she had a fever, because even a corpse has a temperature. I'm not sure what impact I had on him. But this has become a little bit of a personal vendetta with me. For years, when attending parties and individuals would ask me, you know, what do you do? And I would say, I'm a physicist. And the answers generally were either, oh, and then a few pleasantries and they'd walk away. Or they'd say, oh, I could never understand all those numbers and math and everything. I just gave that up long ago. And I accepted that for a number of years. And then I began to think, that's really silly. We can't stand for this. Suppose it were reversed. And I had asked them, what do you do? And the person said, well, I teach English. And I'd said, oh, all those letters and words, and so I could never get that. I gave up reading long ago. Now, what educated person in our society would profess to such ignorance of the humanities publicly? But yet, I find individuals constantly in public professing their total ignorance of science, as if that's all right. It isn't all right. We have to be well educated in all fields, not just the humanities. End of sermon. Third thesis, scientists are politically clueless. I have experimental verification for that. But this actually is a quote from Science Magazine, which wrote an article. The title was The Scientifically Illiterate and the Politically Clueless. And it's just another variation of the two cultures argument of C.P. Snow in the 50s. It really is true, and it's something that has to be corrected. What does our nation need? And this is what the report tries to address. Better science, math, engineering, technology education. It needs a new, concise, coherent, comprehensive science policy, which is what I tried to produce. And we need socially responsible and politically aware scientists. And we'll say a little bit more about what those mean in a few minutes. The report's recommendations, just in four broad categories, and I'll go in just a few more details on that. Basically a statement that the federal government must continue its strong support of basic research, simply because no one else is going to do it. The private sector's role is to fund some basic research, but mostly applied research, building a bridge between the two, bridge crossing what I call the valley of death. And if we have time, we'll talk about that as well. I believe it's important to increase the integration of science and decision-making through the regulatory and the judicial systems. We have to have a regulatory system in which knowledge of science infuses the whole process, rather than some regulator making a decision about what has to be regulated, and then at the end going to the scientists and saying, now what number must we plug in here? Similarly, in the judicial system, scientists are currently being pulled into the adversarial system that has been established through the centuries in the courts. And that is very likely not the optimum way to bring scientific information into the court system, but rather in a more advisory role to the jury and the judge. Finally, I think it's important to improve our system of education from preschool to grad school. And I am working primarily on improving math science education in K-12, and we'll talk about that a bit later. Just to amplify on each of these very, very briefly, and I won't take time to discuss this in detail, but I believe that support for basic research must be stable and substantial. Certainly better than it's been in the past in both regards. That implies long-term budgeting, which is very difficult to do in the Congress. I believe it's important to support interdisciplinary research. That is most likely to be the most important research in the future. It's important to maintain a balanced research portfolio. At the moment, we have immense increases going to the National Institutes of Health, but other areas of science are holding steady or in some cases declining. And that is likely to lead to a great imbalance. And I believe we have to be certain to fund more innovative risk-taking projects. The more we bureaucratize science in the United States, the less likely you are to find the grant makers willing to take risks on projects that may not pay off. Second, the private sector has a role in both basic and applied research and in building bridges between. I think it's important to encourage young startup companies through various legislative means. Make the R&D, that's supposed to be a D, not an E, R&D tax credit permanent. Streamline regulations and pursue and develop effective partnerships. Now, a moment ago, I talked about the valley of death. What basically happens, is supposed to happen, that basic research develops new ideas, new theories, and that these ideas should dribble down and form the basis for applied research and eventually product development. But we have a valley of death developing between the two, which slows down the process. I think it's important either to bridge the gap or to encourage the entrepreneurs over here who often fill the valley of death by taking their ideas when they find no one is willing to market them for them, and they in fact get involved and do the marketing themselves. This, as it replies to a research university, I've tried to, incidentally, in the report, some people believe that I'm adhering to the old idea of the linear approach, as some people call it, where you have basic research and then it, through a linear process, goes into applied research and so forth. That is simply not true. It's far more complex than that. Don Stokes has done some good research in that, as has Jerry Holton of Harvard. And if you would like to talk to me about that afterwards, I'll be happy to discuss that briefly, but there's simply not time in this arena. It's far more complex than just the linear relationships which Vannevar Bush outlined. But to illustrate part of the complexity, if you are really trying to get rid of the valley of death, I believe you have to encourage through legislation and other means, administrative means at universities and so forth, partnerships to tackle particular problems. And I've indicated on this chart some of the parties involved in potential partnerships. And notice I have drawn lines interconnecting all of them. The only one I have not is from state governments to foreign governments. There's no line there because it's unlikely to have foreign governments directly interacting with state governments. Although, since drawing this chart a few months ago, I have discovered a few counterexamples, but they are rare. The point is simply, when people talk about a federal role in product development, applied research, they seem to think it should be federal governments giving grants to industry to perform research. That is a model. I do not think it is the best model. The best would involve certainly partnerships between the federal government and the private sector, but also with state governments, particularly through universities. State governments, after all, are far better at developing programs to help develop local industries or state industries. And they do a much better job than the federal government, which tends to have difficulty adjusting to all the different state situations. Furthermore, the universities are the seats of knowledge and of research in most cases, and they should certainly be involved in helping this. Some of this is going on in very tentative stages, but it has not been systematized, and I hope that by thinking through some of these things, we can develop better means of encouraging partnerships. This will involve federal legislation, certainly, but it also involves a change of attitude at many universities and also the cooperation of state governments. And the federal facilities, the national laboratories, treasures of research. And again, I think they can be more heavily involved in many of these areas. Certainly they are already involved with universities, but can we extend that beyond that? Foreign governments, I'm convinced that we are not likely to have any more major international research facilities that are not fully cooperatively developed through international science and funded in an international way. The death of the SSC, the superconducting supercollider, if nothing else, should convince us that we are not likely to go forward with any of these in the future without full international cooperation and international funding. On the third point about improving our educational system, let me skip through that, through some of these slides, and get to what I'm trying to do now. I have been operating in two-year cycles in the Congress simply because the Congress operates in two-year cycles. And so my first two-year project given to me by Newt Gingrich was to computerize the House. I was astounded when I got there and discovered that it was easier to send an email to Russia than to send it 20 feet down the hall to a colleague. And I mentioned this to Newt. He was fully aware of it, and as someone deeply interested in science and technology, he encouraged me to take the lead. Once we got the majority, he put me in charge. We now have a fully computerized House. Everything's on the net. You can access virtually every House document over the net if you wish. You can watch the sessions on TV on C-SPAN. If you have a question about what's being discussed, you can go to your computer, look up the bill language itself. You can then formulate your opinion, if you have one, and send it off to your member of Congress by letter, by an email on the internet, all within the space of a half an hour. Anyone who believes, as some people say, that the Congress is not in touch with the people simply doesn't know what's going on. We are more in touch with the people than we have ever been in the history of our nation. So my first project was that. Second project, Newt again, because of his interest in science. And Newt did not get fair treatment by either the media or others. He is a complex person, as you well know from reading about some of his current difficulties. He was one of the few people I've met in the political arena who had vision and was concerned about where our nation was going to be 30 years from now. He also was very concerned about science and engineering. So my second two-year project was the science policy study. The third one, which I'm engaged in now, which Newt started and which is strongly supported by the current speaker and by Jim Sensenbrenner, chairman of the Science Committee, just a very, very fine person and a good chairman, and that is to improve math science education in the United States. And question is, why should we do this? What is the problem? Aren't we doing so well already as a nation in terms of science? We are, if you look at our scientific research capability compared to the rest of the world. But part of that is simply a matter of resources. We have the most resources of any country. But secondly, the best scientists from other countries also come here because we have the most resources. And that has sustained it. It's not because of the excellence of our educational system, particularly K-12. I'm often asked, why should we do that? And I've outlined three purposes which I think are important. First of all, the traditional one. We should have a good K-12 math science education system just so that we can produce the scientists and engineers that we need. Many people think we have too many ready. In fact, we have a shortage, and we have a special visa program to allow educated technology, science, engineering specialists into this country. Almost 100,000 of them per year come in because we cannot meet the demand from our own nation. Or just look at the graduate schools of most universities, in which over half of the students come from other countries simply because we do not have enough students able to compete successfully. So we have to do better in that, but that's still our best area. Another place is workplace readiness. I am convinced, or have been convinced for a long time, that within 20 years you will not be able to get meaningful employment in the private sector without an adequate knowledge of mathematics and science. I can give you endless examples, but even if you just look at my congressional office, as I've told my staff, if you worked in this office 20 years ago, you went into a deep Rip Van Winkle sleep and awoke this morning and came to work, you would not know what to do, literally. They could not operate the telephones, they could not operate a copying machine, certainly could not operate a computer, etc. More and more we are going to find this in every workplace, and not all computers are going to be like McDonald's where you have little pictures that you punch. You are expected to have much better knowledge than that. So workplace readiness, I think, is very important. After talking to John Chambers a few weeks ago, current CEO and founder of Cisco Systems, which he has built in only 14 years to a corporation that is now currently the size or valuation of General Motors, after a conversation with him, I became convinced that my estimate is wrong. It'll be in 10 years you will not be able to get a decent job without a good knowledge of math and science. And finally, better voters and consumers. Better citizens and better consumers. By that, it means you'll be able to make better judgments within the political arena, both in terms of issues and who you vote for. And secondly, better consumers being able to judge the claims that are made for products, particularly health products, by having a better understanding of them. The principles I think are important is to teach by doing science, not by teaching about science. And probably the biggest mistake we make today is that our instruction is about science, not doing science, not really understanding what science is. And that gets back to my comment about understanding science as it's practiced. That means teaching science as a mode of inquiry, not just a collection of facts, theories, and results. And that is the key. Science uses a different mode of inquiry than one might use in the humanities or various other fields of study. It is different in its very nature. And it is important that our students understand that already at the elementary and high school level, if they are to learn to think in the way that a scientist thinks, if they are to perform their jobs in science, in society, as they are to be performed. There are several aspects of that. I think it's very important that we improve our curricula. We have some very good curricula there, but the majority are not very good. I believe a good curriculum for elementary school science and certainly for secondary school science is something that is object-centered, experiment-oriented, but yet concept-based. And too often we find the curricula split. They emphasize either the experimental approach, the inquiry-based approach, or they emphasize the concept-based approach. I believe both are essential, and only the really good programs combine those two aspects. And finally, teachers. Teachers are much reviled today and criticized for not knowing math or science, not understanding how to teach it. And in a sense, that is true, but it is not fair to blame them when we have schools of education and universities which do not prepare them to teach properly, do not teach them how to teach math and science, do not give them the bare knowledge they need to understand it. So I think it's important to review and improve teacher training and teacher training requirements. It's also important to recruit and train great teachers. That is easier said than done. 50 years ago, there was a ready supply of teachers. Most female members of the population had little choice. Teachers, nurses, secretaries. So you had an ample supply. Today, there's largely equal opportunity, and many are choosing other fields, and we are losing some of our best teachers. In the meantime, we have not changed our culture to indicate that we need more males in the classroom so that we have true equality there. So I call this particular part, we have to find, we have to train, and we have to keep good teachers, because retention is also a major problem. We have to also assist current teachers by professional development programs, and that's where the federal government can certainly play a role. It does already. We have to improve that. And I believe we may have to look at higher salaries for mathematics and science teachers. After all, we live in a market economy, and if they can earn twice as much money elsewhere, as truly they can, then you have to recognize that factor, or you are always going to have inadequate teachers. You can also, I recognize, make an argument for higher salaries for all teachers, and I would also support that, but there's still going to be a differential of some sort. Finally, it's very important that we improve our research efforts on teaching of science. There's some good work going on at the National Institutes of Health and various other universities. There's also a lot of poor work going on in many locations, and we certainly have to improve there. So I believe it's important that we address those problems. Now, just a few closing thoughts. The report and the comments are a broad brush view, and I hope they are the beginning of a process. This is not intended to be a final verdict on the direction our country has to go, but to stimulate discussion, stimulate thought, particularly in the Congress. And it certainly has stimulated thought and discussion outside of the Congress. It's beginning to develop within the Congress. But as an example, it's the funding for science continues to be a major problem in the Congress. It is just not regarded as a high priority. I skipped over one important reason for that. If you have a science policy, a funding policy, that is based on the fact that we need to do scientific research in order to defeat our enemies militarily, and the Cold War suddenly ends, you've lost the rationale for your research program. We believe we should ever have used that rationale in the first place, but having used it, we immediately are hurt once the Cold War ends. I have tried to educate my colleagues that if they want to think in terms of international competition as a reason for science, we have a better reason now than we did when they had the Cold War, because today the competition is economic, not military. And it is much more severe competition than we ever faced militarily. So if we wish to maintain our rousing economy, we must continue our research efforts, not just in science, but in engineering, mathematics, technology, and of course the humanities, which all play a very important part in this too. Future directions, success will require the participation and contribution of the entire scientific community. That also means, in relation to the questions you're discussing here, the future of the research university, it's not enough just to do scientific and engineering research. Simply not true. You have to place it in the whole total context of the purpose of the university. You also have to relate it to the nation's needs and programs. And above all, you have to relate it to the political system. I would love to have more physicists in the Congress. We now have a second, by the way. Rush Holt from Princeton University has joined me 5 years after I got there. Pretending I was an economist, I did a quick calculation. If you have a doubling time of 5 years, that means in the year 2038, the entire Congress will consist of physicists, which might seem good to me, but I'm not sure it'd be good for society. But we certainly need greater participation, and I hope also that the scientific community will become much more active politically and in addressing social issues. For example, math science education, one of the best things you can do. And incidentally, this is how I got started in math science education 30 years ago, is to simply visit the neighboring school and say, I'm a scientist. I love science. I really enjoy doing it. Could I just talk to your students about why science is fun, why I like it? Can I just let them see what a scientist looks like, what a scientist does, just talk to them about it, or maybe give them a tour of the laboratories? And I think every scientist should be doing that in terms of approaching the neighboring schools and trying to develop some interest. I never met a scientist until I was in college. I was interested in it, but never thought I could be one. I didn't know what they did, what they were. And I think by getting out in the community and doing things of that sort, we can meet our social obligations as well as do our research. Just a final, if you want to read the report, it is out in paperback now. It's not quite a bestseller, but if you want a copy free, just write my office and we'll send you one. Sharon Hayes and Laura Rodriguez were the two science fellows who worked on this. I also had another staff member who helped, Mike Champness, and his name got omitted for some reason. The challenge I leave you with is that you certainly have to redefine the role of the university in this new emerging global society, but you also have to redefine the role of the research university in terms of what is happening in scientific research and how it relates to other things that are going on in the world, and that's where the humanities become extremely important. It's very important, I believe, for the university to help in this matter of educating the public about math, science, and technology, but also very important to educate them about the limits of science, math, and technology. There are certain major questions in our life which science does not address. Obviously, those can be addressed by poets, philosophers, theologians. All of these are extremely important areas of life, And society, I think, has begun to depend too much on, oh, the scientists will take care of this problem. It is also very important, I believe, for the scientific community and the research community to become more politically astute and to communicate better with the Congress and with its citizens. And on that score, I commend President Rawlings. He is one of the few university presidents of this country who has come into my office and said that he would like to talk to me about some of these issues. That's what's needed. And I hope more presidents and more faculty members throughout this land will take an opportunity to do the same thing. I thank you for the opportunity to be here. I wish you a wonderful symposium. I'm sorry I have to leave early this afternoon, get back to Washington, but I went through the program and it looks remarkably good, and I wish I could stay. Thank you very, very much.